All right. Okay. I'm here with two very good friends today who are in the Amazonian region of Ecuador, kind of in the northeast part of Ecuador. We're here with Lexi and Luis, who work at a project called AMISACHO, and they work with another organization called La Clínica Ambiental or the Environmental Clinic. And we're going to get into the work that they've been doing in the Amazon bioregion to promote livelihood security and ecological sustainability through agroecology and through understanding and caring for all of the resources that are available in the jungle. So, with that as a brief intro, it'd be great for you guys just to quickly introduce yourselves a little bit about your background and where you're from and how long you've been working at AMISACHO and some of the main goals that you have for your work there.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Awesome.
Josh. Hi, everybody. I'm Lexi Dwapper. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I actually grew up, I went to university at Appalachian State, and so lived a lot of my years in Boone in the Appalachian Mountains. And for the past 9 years, I've been living here in Lago Agrio in the northeastern Ecuadorian Amazon. And I graduated from App State in biology with a focus in ecology. And I feel like everything I really learned about ecology started once I moved here after graduating. And this is my husband, Luis.
Hello, I'm Luis. I born in here in Lago Agrio, this region, and I study engineering mechanic, but around 8 years ago, when we start to live together, we start to work in this land, and recently we are involved in indigenous territories and knowing and learning how they protect the land. So this is our work now.
I would say Luis might be one of the few mechanics who doesn't work with the petroleum business in the region. So the land that we live on is my in-laws' lands. It's Luis's family's land. It's about 15 hectares right outside of the city of Lago Agrio, which is Lago Agrio was opened up the pristine jungle for petroleum extraction in the 60s. And so it's this little forest reserve that my in-laws started to restore. Actually, it was deforested for cattle, and it's located at oil drill number 26. So there's like an oil drill right at the entrance. That's where you tell your taxi when you come here. And about 14 years ago, my in-laws started this reforestation project on the property, and now it's this living forest with so many species of, flora and fauna that have revived here and are housed here, and lots of visiting birds that come here until they migrate to the next biggest forest, which is pretty far now. And so yeah, so all of the work that we do is kind of based off of this idea of what kind of economies can we what type of diverse economies can we demonstrate based off of the local ecosystem and based off of reforesting and conserving and demonstrating, different styles of agriculture and agroforestry as alternative livelihoods in the area.
But so you mentioned that the site is the area was opened up for oil exploitation going back to the 60s. So give a for listeners that aren't familiar with this, because this has been a huge force that has had a massive effect on the ecosystem and the communities around there. There's a big history, that people can dive into to learn about. But can you give us sort of a review or a snapshot of how the oil exploitation industry has affected the region and a bit of that, just a history of that work and how it's affected the communities there?
Quieres expresar brevemente cómo llegó el petrolero y cómo impactó esa zona, cómo era antes y cómo empezó a abrir el territorio y ese impacto a las comunidades. Y yo te complemento.
So when the exploration started, so the first thing that they made is they open a road for go to the new oil drills. And when you open this new road, many people enter and they want to occupy this new forest, no? So it's like the effect of the espina de pescado.
Like,
So,
it just creates huge fragmenting throughout the forest as the roads start opening up to new drills and farmers, new colonizers start, lining up and taking over the roads.
Yeah, sometimes when people enter, they want to connect different roads, and it's like a rompecabezas, the pequeños parches de selva,
It's like a
something.
puzzle. Yeah, so in the 60s, Texaco, a U.S. owned, and now called Chevron, then it was called Texaco, a U.S. owned oil company, opened up this part of the Ecuadorian Amazon, and it was just jungle. It was pure jungle at that point, and this was Cofan territory. It was the indigenous people, and older Cofans will say that when they were little, they remembered hearing like helicopters and all these loud noises, but they didn't know what it was. And they walked through the jungle and just saw like plots being cut down and huge machinery that they've never seen. And the petrol workers offered them candles, which they ate. They didn't know what it was. They gave them gasoline, which they drank. They didn't know what it was. And sugar, which brown sugar, which they really liked and wanted more. And just the stories of this is just really interesting. But anyways, so like what Luis said was the roads that opened up to new oil drills quickly became colonized. And in order to get land titles, you had to demonstrate that your land was occupied. So you had to demonstrate that more than 50% or more than 70% of your land was worked, therefore cut down. So people would, obtain around 100 hectares per family, and you had to cut down over 70% to in order to get land titles. So you can imagine the colonizing for cheap land, and at the same time, all these new agro industry proposals for monocultures were, that's what the people were learning, and they're, getting seeds delivered to them, and those were the strategies to colonize this new territory, turning it into monocultures for cacao, coffee, African palm, and indigenous communities who didn't have, land titles were slowly becoming enclosed and
Chimuelo.
there's a parrot flying into the kitchen. And that for so many reasons has an impact on their culture and territory and language and wildlife and hunting and fishing and with the extraction increasing, their waters that they bathe with, transport themselves in canoes, drink with, wash their clothes, the children play in where, was becoming net black with, crude oil. And so a lot of illnesses for the first time were developing, and a lot of communities and it had really strong impacts on their culture, especially now with the introduction of cities and alcohol and drugs and prostitution and jobs and money, and now having to work for food and work for money and work for a new lifestyle.
So that's awesome. You just went through a ton of different stuff there. Is it accurate to say that, okay, it was discovered that this area had oil resources by Texaco originally, or the oil companies, and then they come in to start adding roads and clearing land to set up places to drill for oil and pipelines to transport the oil. But it's not just the petrochemical companies and the petrochemical workers that are coming in, but you have a lot of other outsiders coming in, people that are basically like, where are these other people from? They're from Quito, they're from other parts of the country. Are they foreigners coming in? And they're coming in to settle the land for farming purposes. And this is pushing out the indigenous people that just had lived there previously. So, and then you mentioned also crops like cacao and African palm and things like that. So is this like a export commodity crop situation going on? Like what? So I'm just trying to clarify maybe for the listeners, who are some of the main groups that have come in over the past several decades and affected these changes.
Yeah, quiénes son los que han llegado y los colonos de dónde han llegado
de dónde y han por llegado. Qué. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Lo digo en inglés.
Yeah.
The principal group that comes in this area are from Loja. It's a little province in the south, and they have a really dry season in this area, and that's the reason they move and looking for other areas for May agriculture. That's the reason that the naming here actually is Nueva Loja. It's like the new city that they people comes from, no? Perfect. And the principal agriculture in here is cacao, because they can sell and they use for export, and coffee, and they could many land for cows, grow cows, mm-hmm. from meat. So yeah, and many people from the coast, because we have a similar weather, common clima, similar
weather, yeah.
similar weather. So people from the coast and the south on the country, so mm-hmm. the place. Yeah.
Chihuelo.
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of local industries that have formed in order to directly buy from the farmers, African palm fruits, and coffee beans, cacao pods.
Y últimamente malanga también.
Now malanga, which is kind malanga? Of like a... Uh-huh.
What's malanga?
Malanga is...
Como papachina.
I think tapioca is another word for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Tapioca or, yeah. It's like a starchy tuber vegetable.
Yeah. Similar.
And this stuff is mostly for export.
It's all for export.
Okay.
It's all for export, unless it's like high quality, where local, more like organic, conscious minded projects are forming to buy local sources.
Okay.
So like there's a native cacao, actually cacao I understand was is endemic to Ecuador, and it's a cacao, the fino de aroma, the fine aroma, which is the most expensive cacao, and since it's native to the jungle here, it's adapted to shade. And it has the highest price. Mm-hmm. So there's a big movement to bring back that species, to have diverse agroforestry with cacao and people who are buying that cacao for a higher price. But mainly all of the monocultures is to take advantage of production per hectare. And so, you know, it's ignorant to topography and water sources and riverbanks and, you know, anything that's culturally or environmentally or historically important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Como,
go ahead.
No iba a decir como Lexi can explain that I want to say, but como el cacao tiene su nicho debajo del bosque, y como tenemos 6 tipos de cacao, y han sacado todos los tipos de cacao, y solo cultivan uno, pero es como un híbrido, ni siquiera es como un cacao nativo.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he's just saying, so these other cacaos that,
como 6
tipos that everybody's cultivating now are hybrids. There's over six different types of cacao, or maybe even more, but now what everybody's cultivating are like genetically modified hybrids.
Uh-huh.
CC1 and I don't even know what they're called anymore.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you're kind of painting a picture of, on one hand there's the petrochemical stuff, on the other hand there's kind of industrial ag, but these are extractive, two main extractive industries that have become yeah. prevalent and are having, there's the effects of the pollution associated with oil spills and associated with the gas flares, where they burn off the excess methane from the oil wells and the waste pits, pipeline spills and stuff. And then with there's the monoculture plantations and the erosion associated with that kind of farming and the dependence on chemical fertilizers and pesticides and stuff like that. And so, mm-hmm. And those have become powerful forces in the region in recent decades. But it sounds like there are movements of locals, or who are they, just local groups? Are they indigenous groups? Are they NGOs? I mean, but to look at organic production or traditional varieties of cacao, like what kind of pushback is coming from locals against these extractive industries, and how do your work fit in with what's going on in the region?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most amazing things that we know is true is that like 80% of the forests that are still intact are indigenous territory. And there's something about, you know, the reality of the Amazon with its huge diversity of fruits is, in reality, it's all been planted before by nomadic Amazonian tribes and throughout time for generations. And so just kind of like this whole acknowledgement for their stewardship of the forest for millennia, and just the way that they can, you know, survive and thrive within these diverse resources just really demonstrates how, you know, what's possible and how we can actually, you know, thrive as humans in these different ecosystems, instead of adopting these, you know, external, you know, strategies, extractive strategies, which completely change an ecosystem and the climate and the rains and the topography and, you know, our physical relationship with the land. So I think anybody who's an activist or an environmentalist or a biologist or just loves nature, I think we really respect and honor and learn from this long indigenous movement of protection and connection that they have with their land. And so basically a lot of huge news recently is really about like indigenous communities, you know, suing the government or suing the Ministry of Environment for not doing their job and not respecting their rights and not protecting, you know, the country's resources. And now I think for us, well, so I also started to learn, Luis and I started to learn permaculture with the Clínica Ambiental, which means the environmental clinic. You know, instead of like a health clinic, it's called the environmental clinic. And it's a local NGO in Lago Agrio that teaches free permaculture courses to affected farmers and indigenous communities throughout the two petroleum provinces, Sucumbíos and Orellana. And for me, I took the course, I think like 8 years ago, 7 years ago. And for me, it was just like how to survive in a world where your soil's contaminated, your water's contaminated, your food's contaminated, the economy is changing, the climate's changing, and, you know, we have constant, you know, just really huge issues.
Para sobrevivir.
Yeah, the tools, it gives you the tools to survive, the tools to harvest water, the tools to regenerate your own and select your own seeds, the tools to, you know, provide your own food, to process your own food, to store your own food. And even this concept of regenerative economies based off of that is really, you know, what we're pushing towards. And again, permaculture is, you know, combining modern techniques and honoring ancestral wisdom and to create solutions to today's issues. And so for me, I think just one story that I'd like to share was especially during the pandemic when we were everybody was in quarantine, and in the Andes Mountains is where a lot of the vegetables and produce come from, and just supply of medicine and everything comes to the Amazon through the Andes via roads. And during the quarantine, like, those trucks stopped coming. And you went to local stores, the food was, you know, the shelves were empty of food. And being in quarantine, if you weren't an essential worker, you weren't making money. And if you, you know, weren't making money and you're somebody who has to buy water, if you have to pay for food, if you have to pay for medicine, I mean, you're fucked. Like, you're really in a really difficult situation. And this was so true for like a huge percent of Ecuador lives under the poverty line. And so what I was able to really see during that time was like communities and families that were resistant or resilient in those times were families that had their own rain filtration or water filtration, were families that had their own, you know, food, not just crops, not just for selling, but diversity for their own consumption, that had their own medicines. And indigenous communities, same thing, communities that were dependent on tourism or dependent on buying their food outside of their communities, like, for example, certain Kofan communities that are more, have been more affected for by petroleum extraction for decades. They've become more dependent on external income. It was a really difficult time for them, whereas indigenous communities further away who have more autonomy, have more forest, have more, you know, fishing and hunting and diversity in their gardens, you know, were less impacted by, you know, change in politics, pandemics, change in climate, you know, that's something that's really stood out to me. Sorry for that monologue.
That's pretty good. I want to, so you, I've had a chance to witness a few of your projects and stuff, and I think it's super fascinating. And I want to get Luis to talk a bit about, because you guys have really developed some interesting ways of climbing trees. You have some equipment and some techniques that you've been developing for climbing trees, like, for example, to harvest the fruits from the Morete palm. And you can see a Morete palm in the background on the screen there over your head, Lexi. Yes, that's one of the palm trees. Has these really interesting fruits that look like a scaly little egg, like a dragon laid an egg or something like that. So can you talk about the Morete fruit and all of, you know, some of the uses for this and the techniques that you've been developing for harvesting it? Because it's really unique and interesting. I want you to go into that.
¿Quieres hablar acerca de diferentes técnicas de escalarlos, los usos, okay. Cualquier información acerca de Morete y las comunidades
okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. I think around 4 years when we start to work in the communities, we was really interesting about this forest food that the communities use for it. And the Morete was really, really interesting for us because people really like this fruit, no, and other fruits. But I remember a time when we asked for harvest some fruits for made juice and canning, and we go to the Moretal, is the ecosystem where grow Morete, and they actually cut the palm.
They cut the tree down.
They cut the tree for harvest. So because it's so high and so big and it's really difficult palm for climb, and we immediately start to investigate what is the best form for climb. We found different system, and now we use a system, the name is a Makisapa. It's simple ropes, and you can climb, harvest the palm, and use this fruit, no? So how the people use, they heat the seeds, and they can eat the palm. It's really delicious, many nutrients, vitamins, and if you made other process, you can take oil for it, or make some fried things, and they use this in the hair, on the skin. So more the properties that this pod have is how important it is for the culture, no? Many cultures identify with different palms, no? We have Morete, Ungurawa, or different type of acai, native acai, acai. So yeah, now, now many people are training how to climb trees with other different rope systems. So because they have really big, big trees with really delicious foods, and it's almost impossible for climb, and they cut the tree.
Huge trees.
Recently, this weekend, we was walking in the jungle looking for these trees. And I remember one tree that I was listening, the name is Lechewayo, and all the community love this fruit, and I don't understand how big it is, and when I see the tree is too big, and I understand that the reason that they cut. So now they have a system for climbs, And it's interesting how the communities have como un cultivo de los árboles, how do you say this?
Tree
Tree harvester.
cultivo, como
Sí, como no es la forma tradicional de cosechar como maíz, sino es como un cultivo forestal, ¿no?
we call it like tropic culture or agroforestry, where it's just like food forest instead of like corn in an Amazonian system, which is a tree system designed for trees. It's not prairies here, it's giant trees, but having a tropical forestry.
So okay, the idea is the previous method for harvesting this fruit was just to cut the tree down to get the fruit. But you're like, hey, we can if we develop this climbing system where you have some ropes and some techniques and some equipment and stuff, then people can climb a tree, they can harvest the fruit without having to cut the tree down. And then you all have been setting up at your facility, you have all this equipment where you can press out the oil. You can, you can make different types of extracts and all that kind of stuff. So talk a little bit about the processing. So you're able to get Mirete and all these other things from the jungle. You're able to process it into all these different kind of products. So I want you to talk a little bit about the kind of products that you're making and the equipment that you have. And then what's the model? Is the idea that you work with community members who are interested to learn about the climbing techniques? And then you have a hub, a processing hub for making these natural products, or like what's the model? And go into a little bit of detail about the equipment that you have and the type of processing that you do.
Well, I think it's a long story too, because I think just seeing the reforestation and conservation of my in-laws, Luis and I decided to build the laboratory in order to like demonstrate to people that that there are these other types of alternative incomes based off of the diversity of the ecosystems that we live in. So we built the laboratory with that focus to really think about like what are the native species here and in different types of areas that they grow in, and that are just emblematic to ecosystem function, but also important to cultures, and just have just diverse uses. And so Morete was one that was just really stood out to us, especially the more experience and the more we got to exchange with the Secopi Nation, especially because the Morete is predominant in swamps. And so any native swamps are just these massive natural cultures of Morete, and which are commonly being cut down and drained and planted corn into, or turned into other, converted for other crops. And so just kind of giving this emphasis off, not only are they huge carbon sinks, but they like Luis said, they're really important to their culture. And so when we started to learn climbing techniques, and we're working with another NGO called Yakum that works on reforestation of ancestral food forests that helped get the climbing equipment, and also offer support and reforesting and restoring native seeds and huge seed exchanges between communities and networks. But anyways, so we started to explore in our own laboratory, processing native species from native fungi like wild grown Ganoderma to extracting essential oils, canning, and being able to take advantage of fruits that, like here in the Amazon, it's flowering all year long. So this idea of canning is just like was never necessary. There's different types of fruits, and it was never needed. There's never, a winter downtime. And so this idea where now being able to can things and have these fruits last all year and actually be able to consume them all year, but also be able to, sell them and take them to markets without them rotting is a really awesome outlet for such a rich diversity of species that they have. And so but Morete actually isn't well known in Ecuador, and most people don't know what it is, even though it's a huge export in Brazil and Peru and Bolivia, Colombia, all the other Amazonian countries except for Ecuador. And so what really stood out to us was with in the Secopi Nation that I was mentioning before, is they have this huge threat for African palm. And so it's like one of the last like standing jungles is their territory. And on the border of their territory is a much bigger island of African palm.
What's African palm used for?
Making palm oil.
Okay.
For cooking, frying, exporting very cheap oil, accessible oil, very, very cheap.
For a Nutella.
Yeah, for Doritos.
Okay. Yeah. Just to clarify, African palm is a species they plant in a big monoculture to make oil real cheaply for foodstuffs and for things like that.
Right. So you can drive for an hour going to the Secopi territory. You can drive for an hour and not see one other species of trees. You can only African palm.
Wow.
For and that just it's thousands of hectares. And just the impact on the local ecosystem, on water sources, on diversity, and the health of the soil afterwards is really horrific, actually. Mm-hmm. And so we're just thinking, like, if this amazing native palm has such an important factor for native flora, for native fauna, animals, and communities, and carbon sequestration, but it's also like an exported fruit in other countries for its extremely, like Luis said, extremely nutritious properties as an oil, then let's explore that. But so we're like, Luis being a mechanic is like exploring and building different machines, trying to adapt machines that can remove the skin from different fruits and separate the seeds. But this, like, it's like a tiny little coconut. It's really, really tough. Mm-hmm. And so just trying to adapt these machines that are designed for soft fruits. And he's just like messing with them, trying to figure out how to get it to extract the pulp without breaking the seed and shredding the seed into the pulp. And then from there, what if we can, you know, build a press that can help us extract the oil from it, like a cold pressed oil, and then we can have the pulp, and then we can do something, you know, like a flour from the pulp, and just trying to figure out all the diverse ways that we can process it and, you know, make it worthwhile for people to conserve their swamps and, you know, be able to offer them fair prices for their, you know, for their fruits and climbing trees and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to highlight that because to me, that's super impressive to see the type of equipment. A lot of it, Luis, you've designed yourself. You know, you've had to modify equipment or design equipment specifically to handle this. And I think it's super impressive and interesting. The engineering part of my brain like loves to see that kind of thing. So, so where are you at in that work? Do you have processes that are up and running now? Is the idea that community members from around are going to be bringing in their morete and other things harvested from the jungle for you all to process? Like, where are you at in the development of that work?
Okay. Did you want to say something?
Como, yeah, for complement this, maybe that como quizás responde su pregunta, but yeah. Now we open our lab for the community's comes and use the installations. And many times we use for investigation, what is the best technique for take the oil, for example, because people eat the pulp, this morete palm, and they use the oil for different things. No? So we investigate, we use the cold press, and we invite people from the community. We teach how made the process, and we provide some machines. So now in the community have a little version of machine that they can take oils. Oh. And now they're in some creams,
mm-hmm.
and soap,
mm-hmm.
jabon,
soap.
And como
canning,
repellent. So the important thing here is we can investigate the different process in the lab. And when we are, como si se seguros,
when we're sure,
when we share, We can share the knowledge and people in the community can replicate. And yeah, maybe in the future we can take some little labs in the communities for process pumps.
Yeah. One of the things here about like local permits, in order to be able to like sell into stores and actually move in high quantity your products, you have to have certain permits. And they're really difficult and they're very expensive. So for the time being, this year we've decided that we want to legalize our laboratory. And for the past 6 years, we've been teaching how to process, and we've worked with local NGOs to deliver processing equipment and oil press and dehydrators and canning and making soaps. And that's really amazing. And we also identified the difficulties from territory. You know, there are a lot of communities that are just, you know, for distance and traveling by canoe, and just for different types of barriers and educational barriers and physical barriers to markets and cities. It's really difficult to get their products out into the city and like create this whole, you know, marketing strategies and administration. And so we've identified this kind of like niche need of creating this bridge between territory and market and city. And so with the laboratory, like, one, we want to continue to investigate. Two, we want to continue to train, you know, train professionals and exchange with community members, opportunities for them to continue to learn and get experience and, you know, exchange knowledge and their ability to replicate anything, you know, that they have interested in. And so, you know, sometimes it's difficult to know what should, you know, in the community, what kind of, you know, products can we make, or without ever having that opportunity to know what's possible or how it's made. So when a lot of times when they come into the laboratory, they get really inspired, they see how it's done, and it's easier to identify like what there's actual interest in. And so then they, you know, and for example, in this community, now they're really interested in cold pressed oils. And so we were able to deliver an oil press with a local NGO, and now that's one of the products that they're producing. And now they're learning with us, like, how do you, you know, making, they're using our like repellent recipes and other recipes to elaborate their oil. But either, but still, you know, the permits is still difficult, getting legalizing permits. And so we've been thinking about, with by legalizing our laboratory, we can move primary material, we can try and move more elaborated products while still training people. And when it comes and, you know, creating certain projects that could potentially replicate laboratories in territory that have, you know, now that we know what's needed to be done, now, you know, we can make concrete decisions and proposals and replicate certain methods and laboratory designs. But that's, you know, it's a bigger vision, and we're still just trying to create knowledge about it, create a demand for these products, and try and stimulate economies little by little, and interests and passions. And
so if I understand right, you're working on multiple fronts. On one hand, through your investigations, you figure out good methods for processing certain products. And then in terms of training and having the equipment, you know, providing that to interested communities that can do it, but they may not necessarily be able to sell their stuff commercially because it's not from a quote unquote certified lab, but your facility now is certified. So materials can pass through your lab, and the products that you generate are, have the sort of official stamp of approval that they can be sold commercially in markets at businesses and things like that. Is that, do I have that correct?
Yeah, I think you said that better than I could.
I'm just seeing if I follow along with what you say, but it's, I mean, I'm having been there and stuff. I think it's super impressive. And the Luisa's skill for like fabricating all these different devices is just, it's really amazing. So it's really cool to see that. And I didn't know that you had begun to provide equipment also out to the communities too. I thought everything was just coming through your facility, but that's cool that you're able to provide that stuff.
Luis built essential oil distillers, dehydrators, oil press.
Yeah, why do you need? Tell me what you need.
All right, so we're on the topic of building crazy stuff. Tell us about this Contiki Super Loco that you've been working on and your biochar work.
Acerca del cono loco.
Yeah, kind of like the story of how we met Josh. Yeah, Luis and we've actually been following Josh, your work and Aqueous Solutions for probably like 8 years.
Oh, wow.
But anyways, but we built what's called a Contiki kiln. I just showed blueprints to it one day to Luis.
But when we start making charcoal,
yeah.
But we started looking Josh and the telluride.
Oh yeah, that's right. We did. We started the telluride, the top lift updraft. first, and we were making char with the telluride, and then we learned about the Luis built the telluride, and then he built the Contiki kiln. And one day we reached out to Josh on Facebook and just like, hey, do you think this Contiki kiln would be good for water filtering? Like, this is what we use for making biochar. This is what we teach locally. And you're like, can I come visit y'all? It was so cool. And you flew down here without even knowing us. And it was, and we both ended up being from Appalachia, which was so cool. And just another loco, another crazy dude interested in fire and with Luis. That's willing to burn their face in fire, Luis said.
Right.
And so the first year that Josh came down here, he, you know, we opened up workshops with the Clínica Ambiental and with the Union of Affected People Against Texaco, and just kind of did this bigger general awareness about, you know, how these nocive chemicals can and are entering into our water sources, especially in this region that has all these like gas flares, petroleum gas flares all over the region. And most people just have home water rainwater filters with sand. And so it was just like, it became really apparent that we needed not just biochar filters, but like well-made biochar in order to absorb different chemicals that can potentially be in the water. So last year was all about just like low cost methods of making your own water filters, and that really changed a lot of work for, you know, the direction of work with the Clínica Ambiental and the water filters that people install throughout the region. And then this past trip, and Josh came back and taught us how to just kind of like exposed us to this world of how we can start to investigate and create data that can help us interpret and analyze if, you know, char made from this substrate and used with this water source, you know, can be efficient and withdrawing chemicals, and how long, you know, how big to make the char filter, how often to replace it. And so that was really a game changer for us, and, you know, really trying to create security about the water we're drinking. But y entonces tú construiste un Contiki, que es hablar del Contiki loco.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, ¿por qué lo construiste y tamaño?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, working with the telud, you know, you need a little pieces exactly to put and don't close to air. And we live near the broomsticks factory. So every 3 or 4 days, they bring a mountain of different broomsticks that they don't use, and different size, different thickness. And
broken broomsticks.
Broken broomsticks. And actually thinking for process this for a telluride can be possible, but looking all the quantity that they produce every week, that is really difficult. No, so we start making a hole in the ground, in the soil, and after we build a little Contiki, and after look how big are the mountains, we decide to build a really big Contiki now, that we call the Contiki Loco. Actually works, but yeah, we are looking how is the temperature measuring, so it's some difficult with the temperature working too near, como
It's
working
still in the
too.
investigative
Yeah, but
investigation phase.
the reason for build this big machine was for processing all these brooms still, you know? So yeah, now this part is in process. We want to make this process safe for the people who's working with this. But yeah, now we are measuring this charcoal qu quality with the process that you teach us. And yeah, we're preparing the new area for made a little process center, charcoal center, something like that, to receive all these broomsticks and burn this area. Or now actually it's in a trailer for move this Contiki in the area where the factory is. So yeah, it's a little logistic that we need to understand what is better, what is the best
Yeah.
option.
So just to kind of review for some of the listeners that maybe some of this biochar stuff is a little bit obscure. The idea is that there's different models of kilns, different types of setups that you can use for making biochar. And what makes the most sense, it depends a lot on your application and your situation. And
Yeah.
so you did the drum oven style, the T-Lud, the drum oven style, because that was available with some information online and stuff, but then you wanted to scale it up to be able to accommodate more material. And then the really clever thing was to make this Contiki, but make it larger and make it mobile on a trailer. Because so you're talking about the broomsticks, this is an area where obviously there's a lot of products that are made from wood from the jungle, right? Carpentry shops and lumber and all this kind of stuff, and they have all this
Yeah.
waste material that just piles up and just gets burned in just big open piles. So the
Yeah.
idea would be to be able to bring the biochar kiln to where all the wood, waste wood is piled up, rather than try to haul that wood to where the biochar is, haul the biochar kiln there and make the biochar where the waste is located, and then bring that back. So you've been doing several iterations of different kiln styles to see what makes the most sense. And so, like, where are you right now? Do you feel like this mobile biochar unit is the way to go, or do you feel like, what have you learned in this process so far, and where do you think you're going in terms of your biochar production?
¿En qué, dónde estamos ahora?
¿Cómo te sientes con cómo dónde ves esa producción de biochar yendo? ¿Cómo es
Ya.
el fase ahora?
Ya,
¿Cómo
ya.
lo imaginas?
Ya. Actually, looking the Contiki local, how big it is, and looking the Brumstein productions, I think we need to be a more local Contiki.
Oh,
Because,
wow.
yeah, because when we burn, we take just 2 days production, and that was,
It was nothing.
yeah, there was nothing. So, a possibility can be for build a really big Contiki and como es estable.
Yeah, well, sorry, I just had a sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just had a thought that, like, even if while we're studying its efficiency for water filters, it's still an amazing way to prevent them from burning it and converting it into soil char.
Right.
And that really is a huge impact. So, at least maybe even having multiple instead of a bigger one that nobody can manage, maybe having just multiple that we can maneuver.
Okay.
I don't know. Knowing, knowing you and Josh together, we'll
It's
probably create something massive.
I definitely want to highlight for the audience that, like, if we're making water filter, I mean, you can make biochar for lots of purposes. If we're making water filter biochar, we're trying to achieve really high temperature conditions, like 900 or 1,000 degrees Celsius. Like, this is really, really, really hot. And so you have this giant inverted cone of metal and
Yeah.
chucking wood into it, and you're trying to build up this huge fire. And ultimately, inside this bed of charcoal, you're trying to get up to maybe up to 1,000 degrees Celsius. And it's just, if you're within 5 feet of the thing, you just feel like your face is going to melt off.
Yeah,
So
Louise likes that.
that's the loco part.
That is the reason I am in life.
What makes him feel alive.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Exactly.
a little sweat lodge action right there. Cool. Well, that's really cool. I want to start to wrap soon, but I guess what I mean, We'll put some information in the links below the video to connect with Amisacho and La Clínica Ambiental and to learn more about your stuff. It's a super fascinating project. I feel super lucky that I've gotten to know you guys and visit you a couple times and work with you because it's so cool. I guess what I'm wondering is that, the audience for this podcast is international, but a lot of the audience is in the US or in Western Europe and things like that. Maybe to finish up, like what are your messages based on your experience in the Amazon and working with indigenous communities and working with agroecology and trying to come up with all these different sustainable livelihood techniques and all this kind of stuff? What message do you have for us here on the other end of things? Oh, you guys are sideways. There you go. Yeah,
Yeah.
just what more do you want to tell us about your organization, your work, your projects, and what message do you have for us?
¿Qué mensaje quisieras compartir con otras personas alrededor del mundo? Como en general, o para ellos tomar en cuenta en sus vidas, o
Yeah.
como para cerrar la llamada.
Okay. I think the more important thing is for be conscious about your environmental around you. Looking the cycles and the natural process is important. And yeah, and trying to be connected with your land or wherever you live, trying to be connected with the nature. Yeah, I think it's important. ¿Cómo se dice? Saludable,
Healthy.
healthy. And yeah, that is it.
Yeah, I just have to emphasize that. I feel like when I came here as a graduated biologist, I felt like I knew nothing. No offense to my university, but it was just my I feel like you really learn in the field, you learn with the communities, you learn in the practice, and I feel like the most important thing is to really know, like Luis said, get to know your local ecosystems, learn how your local water cycle actually works, where your water comes from, what your watershed looks like, and what your native species are and the threats on them, and also what is it that the local indigenous movements are asking for and speaking up for. I think that really is probably the direction to support. If you don't know where to support, start there. And I think it's that. I think just the more you start to learn about the environment and how it works and just the little details, the more you fall in love with it, and the more you know, the more you're willing to protect it. I feel like the less we know about our environment, the less impact we feel, the less we understand, the less we understand the impacts of its degradation. And so I feel like that's really the biggest take-home message is kind of just wherever you are in the world and inform yourself. It's really exciting. The more you get into it, the more you want to learn and the more benefits in your personal life and health and mental health that you also achieve for yourself and your family.
That's very beautiful. That's a great way to end. So thank you so much to Lexi and Luis of Amisacho in Ecuador. And we'll definitely check back in with you in a few months and see what kind of Contiki Loco trouble and other kind of loco trouble.
Please do
Yeah.
check back in. We should,
Wait for you.
next time we can have it in the laboratory or by the kiln and we can film from there.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a lab tour or a biochar burn or something like
Action
that.
podcast.
Well, thank you so much for being on
Yeah.
the podcast, and we'll catch up with you sometime in the future.
Thanks so much, Josh. Thanks, everybody. Ciao.